Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Sandra Beasley. Sandra Beasley's first collection, Theories of Falling, won the 2007 New Issues Poetry Prize, judged by Marie Howe. Her poems have appeared in Poetry, Slate, and The Believer, and her nonfiction has been featured in the Washington Post magazine. Her new book, entitled I Was the Jukebox, won the Barnard Women Poets Prize and was just published in 2010 by Norton, W.W. Norton and Company, to be specific. And congratulations on that.
Thank you.
That is a great, great thing.
Yeah, I got the news at midnight in a faraway city staying at a friend's house and couldn't wake anybody up. So I just jumped up and down in my pajamas and stocking feet, getting excited for myself.
It's really, really great, a great accomplishment. So glad to have you here from Washington, D.C. And you're going to start with some poems from I Was the Jukebox.
Yes. Right? I'll start with the title poem. Many of the poems in this book focus on occupying voices outside the traditional self, so voices that are inanimate or mythological. You were you. I dreamt we were in your favorite bar. You were you. I was the jukebox. I played Sam Cooke for you, but you didn't look over once. I wanted to dance. I wanted a scotch. I wanted you to take your hand off of her. You were wearing your best smile and the shirt that makes your eyes green. If you had asked, I'd have told you her hair looked like plastic. But then my mouth was plastic. I weighed 300 pounds. I glittered like 1972. A man tried to seduce me with quarters, but I could hear his truck outside, still running. I was loyal to you. I played Aretha, Marvin, the Reverend Al, you kissed her all the way out the door. Later, I tried to make my own music, humming one circuit against the other, running the needle up and down. The bubbles in my blood were singing. In the morning, they came to repair me. So in the same way that that poem occupies the voice of a lovelorn jukebox, I wanted to also move into the voice of orchids, of all things. And when I was trying to do a little bit of research for the poem, I discovered that the idea of an orchid is actually rooted in Greek myth. There was a figure, Orchis, who was, you'll hear what happens to him. Orchis speaks. Imagine having one good leg and keeping your ovary in it. I grow tired. I grow fickle. I grow on corpses. I am secretly excited when trees catch fire. My mother lives in New Guinea and weighs a ton. In the cloud forests of Costa Rica, my smallest sisters mutter, "Bite me," through purple lips seen only with a magnifying glass. In the 1800s, scientists claimed we could not be grown in a lab, so we did, just to spite them. Now, every year brings some humiliating study on the aunt who reeks of carrion or the uncle in the Yunnan who won't stop fertilizing himself. I won't be another table pet. Sometimes at the farmer's market, a woman with yapping dogs looks at me, and all I can do is droop. God, no. I dream sometimes of Greece, two legs, the festival where I drank too much wine. When the priestess said, "Come here," I came. When she said, "Stop," I kept coming. The guests made a red circle around me. They grabbed my hair, my arm, chanting, my other arm, pulling, clawing the skin until it surrendered from muscle, the unbearable tearing, and I wake, unable to scream, with this lush, exploded tongue. So when I'm trying to get into the world to write a poem in one of these speak series, I kind of dredge up all of the surrounding detail that I can. So in the case of the orchid, it was a matter of thinking about the different types, the ones in the cloud forests of Costa Rica, the ones that weigh a ton, the one in the Yunnan that won't stop fertilizing itself. And I enjoy that research as a way of writing poetry that kind of steps outside my own life and accesses other parts of the world, other cultures, other times. Another poem in the Speak series that in essence became a dramatic monologue is actually in the voice of a platypus, of all things. And it's called The Platypus Speaks, and it's in a particular form called the sestina, which is a fairly acrobatic form. You'll notice that in the first stanza are what will sound like a series of end words that are then repeated over and over. So if I sound like I'm repeating myself, it's not your imagination. The platypus speaks. As far as the duck-billed platypus goes, I'd like to point out there's no other kind of platypus. You don't say horse-hooved deer or moth-winged butterfly. A beast should be her own best description. I deserve that, having survived 100,000 years of "You would make a fine-looking hat." Years take their toll. The right ovary that goes on the fritz every time, flat feet, and that tangled mess of sex, 10 different kinds of X, Y, and yeah, blind dates tend to be a disaster. We're no sluts like the deer, though. June through October only, my dear. Then we build deeper burrows for the year, each dirt plug a form of daycare. To be a mom must suck, or so the saying goes, except we've got no teats, only a kind of belly gully where milk pools so that the platypups can lap it up. Take that, Disney. Bambi's mom was never a dear daiquiri. Takes a particular kind of woman to do that for 7 years, twins every time, while the deadbeat dad goes back to his bachelor pad. He must be so satisfied, lazy as a queen bee, stroking his only weapons, hind spurs that barnacled to his ankles. Out he goes with enough venom to kill angry deer, but would he save me from hunters? No. Years teach me not to expect a card, a kind Mother's Day word, or flowers of any kind. There's no alimony in the wild, beware. Even minor developments take years. But evolution's crawl has its perks. That way I track electric waves, swift as deer, swiveling to go as the hot shrimp goes, each soul spark a kind of beacon. If that makes me the bad guy, Disney, be a deer and live all my years. You'll see how it goes.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Sandra Beasley. And she's reading from her new book, I Was the Jukebox. It's the winner of the Barnard Women Poets Prize, just published in 2010. I want to ask you about really what you said about occupying voices, which is all through your book. You talked about the research of that and looking up with the orchid poem, for example, you know, all kinds of orchids, and writing as a way to get outside your own life. And yet in the orchids and in the other poems, in the orchid poem and in the other poems, it seems like an opportunity as a listener. It seems like an opportunity to sort of infuse these objects with, you know, whatever you want. So, I mean, it seems like the writer's life, the writer's choices, the writer's passions are never far away.
Yeah, I think that it is a little bit of a bait and switch because on one hand, I moved into this series of poems because my first book, Theories of Falling, was very much more rooted in biography and kind of the conflation of poet and speaker. And I wanted to do something different. I wanted to push away. Now, of course, you know, you end up writing a poem like The Platypus Speaks and you look at it a month later and you see there might be some frustrations with the roles of motherhood, which I don't presume myself at this point in life, but it's on my mind and, you know, or talking with my own mother and, you know, and so you never can get entirely away from the self. But I think in a way it would be a failure if I did, because if you don't keep that intimacy and that humanness and that urgency, even when you're speaking as an inanimate object, then there's no risk there, you know?
Right, right. I always feel compelled to bring up that point because so many students so many really younger writers seem to be wanting to run, fleeing from the self. And I'm like, hey, guess what? You really can't.
No, that's true.
and I knew you knew that. But I'm interested in how exacting your poems feel and sound and the precision in your lines and your word choice. And one thinks that is in all poems, but it isn't. But it really breaks out and becomes so visible and audible in your work. It seems to me it supports the edge of the voice in your work, especially, you know, thinking about I'm still on the orchid poem, you know, that those lines in that poem, I am secretly
excited when trees catch on fire.
You know, you don't hear that often.
That's because people don't admit it, but
that's
we are.
Right.
We all are excited.
That's right.
You know, what's funny is that I think that in a way, threads of earlier lives that I've led come through. I spent a period studying the sciences, thinking that I would go into science or technology. And I think in that sense, you see my obsession with accuracy. For example, with the platypus poem, there were certain things that if I had just been able to tweak rhythmically, it would have fit better, but I was wedded to the facts that I had found out about platypuses. So you see the scientist in me. You also see the debater. There was a time back in college when I did a lot of debate and oratory, and, you know, there's a convention in debate of defining the terms where you can't simply assume that synonyms in common speech equal the exact same thing. So you have to define the terms. And I like when I enter the world of a poem, I think a lot of times what I do is I define the terms and explore them.
Okay. Could you read some more poems?
Sure. One of the other themes that runs throughout I Was the Jukebox is the theme of wartime. I look a lot at militarized culture, both in terms of contemporary day and in terms of Greek military tradition. And so I wanted to read one more of the Speaks poems that actually leads off the collection. And this is in the voice of sand. And my father, who was a soldier, taught me that sand is not a material, it's a size. Anything can be sand. And I wanted to write a poem from this kind of pluralistic voice. And I found myself, when I was free associating, thinking about sand, thinking of all of those images you see in the World War II movies of soldiers as they fall to the shores that they're trying to storm. The sand speaks. I'm fluid and omnivorous, the casual kiss. I'll knock up your oysters. I'll eat your diamonds. I'm a mutt. No one thing at all. Just the size that counts. And if your animal small enough, come. If your vegetable small enough, come. If your mineral small enough, come. Mothers, brush me from the hands of your children. Lovers, shake me from the cuffs of your pants. Draw a line, make it my mouth. I'll name your country. I'm a yes man at heart. Let's play hide and go drown. Let's play pearls for his eyes. When the men fall, I like the way their arms touch, their legs touch. There are always more men who bring bags big enough to hold each other. A man who kneels down with a smaller bag, cups and pours, as if I could prove anything. The theme of wartime and of military life is also present in an earlier book of mine, Theories of Falling. And it's interesting when you grow up in a military household, a lot of people presume that you will be anti-war or in some patriotic way, not pro-war, but, you know, the reality of military families is that you live in a neutral zone. Your leadership comes and goes, but the people stay in the field. So in Theories of Falling, I had to address my kind of relationship with American culture. And there's a poem that I'm going to read called The Angels that gets at that. There's a figure in it named Mr. Maupin. Mr. Maupin was the father of a soldier that went missing under my father's command. He was the only MIA in Iraq for a number of years. And Mr. Maupin swore he would not cut his hair until his son came home. And so I would go to these very fancy military events, and amidst all the people in dress uniform, there would be Mr. Maupin in his fishing vest with his beard grown out and his hair down past his shoulders. The angels. They have two noses, six eyes in the arch of each foot. They never tire of blinking down at the Americans, our surfboards, machine guns, our dancing hamsters, the way we shower every day, then rub more oil into our skin. One notes, there is no end to the number of things they can hydrogenate. One checks the spaces in bubble wrap to see if we store useful things inside. Every April, two men create a thing. Then the fruit flies start dying. By each November, one man has a button, and 4,000 men have the job of making sure he does not push the button. One angel notes, there is no end to the number of buttons. One angel visits 100 random bedrooms. His third ear records that Oh God is still popular. He notes a rise in couples sleeping side by side, holding hands tightly. He calls this the Red Rover, Red Rover position. Four angels are assigned to the homeless and tend to school teachers who tend to jump from bridges more often. The one in charge of soldiers sketches the long beard of Mr. Maupin, who swore he wouldn't shave until his son came home. Mr. Maupin sleeps in a blue recliner, still in his fishing vest, one pocket stuffed with lures, the other with laminated baseball cards of his son Matt's face. The backsides of each card show an angel. All cookie-cutter wings and halo, yellow ribbons for hair declaring not one left behind. The angel sighs and goes to sip whiskey with the angel of telemarketers. Every night they watch lights dance across thousands of blue screens as if they note constellations. Every night, they listen to the click of our million keyboards, toasting the sound American souls make as they collide. In the Theories of Falling collection, there's also a number of poems that address allergies, food allergies of all things, which is a condition that in my life is quite severe and deadly, really, and I've had it since childhood. And the material that I addressed in these poems has later come back in the form of a memoir that I'm working on that will be out next year. It's called Don't Kill the Birthday Girl, Tales from an Allergic Life, and it'll be published with Crown. But before I knew that I would ever write about that in nonfiction, I wrote about it in these poems. These are just a couple of short sections from Allergy Girl. Wasting, a hunger so great I bite through a pacifier. My mother tries to fix me with more milk, more milk. Doctors run tests on my squalling body. No breast is safe, no cow, goat, soy milk. I nurse on apple juice. My parents agree on one rule, don't break the baby. They pour quarters into the arcade game of adulthood, working the mechanical claw right, left, right, back, aiming for the stuffed bear, missing a clutch of cheesecake, a buttermilk biscuit. Each time, my lips swelling, breath skipping, they pace the ER. Did we break the baby? My mother dissects labels, casein, protein, lactylate, easier to cook from scratch. My father perfects, shh, it's not that bad. You can breathe, breathe. They cradle me in Benadryl. That's the secret of their marriage, bleary silence in white rooms, too busy not breaking me to take the wrecking ball to each other.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Sandra Beasley, and she's reading her poetry. One thing that I really admire about your work is the sense of not knowing where the poem's going to go. You know, when you're reading, I don't know where it's going, and I love that, you know.
It's terrifying when you're writing them because I'm not sure either.
Okay. Well, I was wondering if some of that has to do with, in your new book, I Was the Jukebox, if some of that has to do with this interaction between research and the voice that comes in, because it seems to me it opens up a lot of possibilities as in direction, where you could go with it.
Yeah, in a way it's the same as an actor getting into character. You know, I do the research because it gives me kind of fun things to bounce off, but I also know at the end of the day that, you know, a poem can't be a Wikipedia entry broken up over lines. You have to find some bigger truth. You have to kind of get at something. And so, you know, I should also admit that many of the poems in I Was the Jukebox were composed in a period of compressed drafting. I was literally trying to get a poem drafted by midnight of each day for a month at a time. And so sometimes the initial draft would be all voice, you know, and then I have to go back and anchor it with research, or all research, but the spark of life wasn't really there yet.
Mm-hmm.
But I liked writing that way. It was very different for me. I'm usually more methodical, but
mm-hmm. That sounds methodical to me. I mean, what would be more methodical?
Well, I guess it was not methodical in the sense that I didn't know where the poems were going to end. And when I first, you know, like many MFA students,
mm-hmm.
Sometimes I would go into a poem and I would think, oh, I've already nailed my ending. The workshop is going to love this. And the whole poem became an excuse to get to that ending.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm letting go of that as I move forward as a writer, I think.
Okay. We have time for a couple more poems.
Okay. I really love Pittsburgh, and I find a lot of excuses to come here. And one of the ones that I enjoy the most is there's a program in town called the Unemployment Show that addresses issues facing people like me who are trying to balance what they want to do and what they need to do to pay the rent. And there's a poem that I will dedicate to those attached to the Unemployment Show, including my friend Dave English. It's called Vocation. For 6 months, I dealt baccarat in a casino. For 6 months, I played Brahms in a mall. For 6 months, I arranged museum dioramas. My hands were too small for the Paleolithic, and when they reassigned me to lichens, I quit. I type 91 words per minute, all of them help. Yes, I speak Dewey Decimal. I speak Russian, Latin, a smattering of Tlingit. I can balance 7 dinner plates on my arm. All I want to do is sit on a veranda while a hard rain falls around me. I'll file your 1099s. I'll make love to strangers of your choice. I'll do whatever you want, as long as I can do it on that veranda. If it calls you, it's your calling, right? Once I asked a broker what he loved about his job, and he said, making a killing. Once I asked a serial killer what made him get up in the morning, and he said, the people.
I love that poem.
Thank you. Okay. Well, there's another poem that I will dedicate to a place I've never been, which is Omaha. I don't fear death, but what I'm really picturing is Omaha, field after field of sorghum crisp to my touch, and one house on a high hill, sheets on the line. You tell me everything ceases, that even our fingernails give up. But what I really believe is that we keep growing, infinite corn, husk yielding to green husk. I look back on the miles connecting me to earth, think I'd have never worn those shoes. I slip them off like anything borrowed. The clouds are thin and yellow, smelling of fireworks and salt. In Omaha, the town votes me queen of everything. You are the slow dance, the last ring of smoke, to be held tight, and then only this colder air between us.
We have time for one more.
Well then, the appropriately named Exits. In the end, a man bolts from the ice cream parlor. In the end, a woman gets in the convertible. In the end, a hat check girl slaps her gangster. In the end, a gambler kisses his bookie. In the end, there will often be a helpful sign. The end, and the iris of the camera tightening shut. Someone will turn on the lights. Someone will pick up the popcorn. Except this time, the room stays dark. There is no light switch on your side of the door. And it's your passport, your suitcase, your young wife. The chief of police saying, "We'll process your papers." His gunman saying, "Your papers have been processed." You realize there's been a terrible mistake, that this is not the light comedy you signed up for. Someone nailed the trap door shut. Somewhere, your parachute is waiting. All over America, good mothers are baking pie after pie after pie. Good mothers drinking glass after glass after glass. This only works if you play the part as written. In the gingerbread house, something must burn.
Poetry of Sandra Beasley. Thank you so much for being here. It was great.
Thank you. I'm really pleased. Thank you.
You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in at our new time every Wednesday night at 7:30 for Prosody, 91.3 WYEP.